his effort to stop any further investigation of Flynn and his inappropriate contact with Flynn post-firing, he asks Comey 4 times to declare that the Russia investigation is not and will not be looking at him. Commands White House counsel Don McGahn to try to get Sessions to unrecuse himself from the Russia investigation, and then personally lobbies Sessions himself, while also, according to the New York Times, complaining to friends about how much he would like to get rid of Mr. Sessions because of his decision to recuse himself, and unsuccessfully tries to convince both his Director of National Intelligence and his NSA Director to help him push back against the FBI investigation and publicly deny the existence of any evidence of collusion during the 2016 election, requests that both men deem inappropriate and refuse. Trump had earlier made the same request of Obama's Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, asking him to directly refute the Steele dossier, and had been denied then, too. Clapper will observe in a May 2018 interview on MSNBC that in his interactions with the president-elect, Trump's focus seemed to be on the dossier. All of these actions beg the question of what it was in the Steele dossier Comey shared with Trump on January 6th that initiated Trump's intense concern about federal law enforcement's ongoing consideration of Russia's ties to his presidential campaign. The day after Trump fires Comey, he hosts Sergei Kislyak and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov in the Oval Office. The latter features prominently in the Steele dossier as one of the Russian officials aware of the Kremlin's interference campaign. The former had met secretly with many of Trump's national security aides. As the Washington Post will report, while Lavrov and Kislyak are in the Oval, Trump brags about the intelligence he receives and shares highly classified information from a U.S. partner with Lavrov and Kislyak. It will later be revealed that the U.S. partner is Israel, and the intelligence is the classified details of a February 2017 military action against ISIS in Syria. Worse still, writes Newsweek, Trump is alleged to have revealed the name of the city where the operation took place, leading to fears that the source who alerted the Israelis to ISIS's intentions may be compromised. Trump also brags to the 2 Russian officials about firing Comey, calling the former FBI director crazy and a nutjob, and saying that with Comey gone, the great pressure he had been facing because of Russia has been taken off. The next night, Trump tells a national television audience via an interview with NBC News' Lester Holt that he fired Comey because of this Russia thing. He also confirms that he had been planning to fire Comey regardless of the recommendations he solicited and received from Attorney General Jeff Sessions and Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, both of which supported Comey's firing. Annotated history. In the final few days of Flynn's tenure as National Security Advisor, the Kremlin attempts to pass a sanctions relief proposal to Flynn, framed as a peace deal for Ukraine, through a Kremlin-allied Ukrainian politician, Andriy V. Artemenko. Artemenko meets with Trump business partner Felix Sater and Trump attorney and fixer Michael Cohen. At the meeting, he hands them an envelope with the Kremlin-approved anti-sanctions proposal inside. The envelope later ends up on Flynn's desk. Cohen at first acknowledges bringing the envelope to the White House and giving it to Flynn, and then changes his story and says he had no interest in what Artemenko was selling and told the Ukrainian to mail his proposal to the White House by regular mail if he wanted to contact President Trump. According to a February 2017 New York Times article, on February 6, 2017, Michael Flynn, just a week from his resignation as Trump's national security advisor, received a sealed proposal hand-delivered to his office. Inside was a plan for President Trump to lift sanctions against Russia. The Times reported that the plan was being pushed by Michael Cohen and Felix Sater in cooperation with a Ukrainian politician who had proudly informed Cohen and Sater that the plan had received encouragement from top aides to Mr. Putin. That Sater should again be attempting to connect Putin and Trump on what he euphemistically called peace, and indeed the Times categorized Artemenko's proposal as a peace plan for Ukraine and Russia, is not surprising given his astounding level of access to Putin as far back as Ivanka Trump's 2006 foray into Putin's office. That by peace, Sater meant peace for three countries, Russia and Ukraine, but also the United States, was confirmed by his February 19, 2017 statement to the Washington Post on the Artemenko proposal. "I got excited about trying to stop a war. I thought if this could improve conditions in three countries, good, so be it." And to the Times, Sater said in justification of his actions, "I want to stop a war, number one. Number two, I absolutely believe that the U.S. and Russia need to be allies, not enemies." As ever, though, the improvement of relations between America and Russia depended, in the Russian view, on the lifting of U.S. sanctions. It is difficult to believe Cohen's representations about his handling of the proposal from Artemenko. Just days after the New York Times scoop on the peace deal, the Washington Post asked Cohen about the allegation that he had delivered a sealed envelope to Flynn, Trump's national security adviser. Cohen responded that he had taken the envelope from Artemenko, but had done nothing with it and had never discussed it with anyone ever again. He added that he had advised Artemenko, even as he was taking the sealed envelope from the Ukrainian politician, to mail his envelope, the very one Cohen had just taken, to the White House at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue via regular mail. Reached for comment by the Post, the Times stood by its more plausible account of events, which it said had been sourced from Cohen himself just days earlier. Mr. Cohen told the Times in no uncertain terms that he delivered the Ukraine proposal to Michael Flynn's office at the White House, Times Deputy Manager Editor Matt Purdy told the Washington Post. In fact, Cohen had said quite a bit more than that, telling the Times that he brought the Artemenko proposal with him to the White House on a day he was scheduled to meet with President Trump himself. He left the proposal in Flynn's office while there, he said. His implication that he brought a Kremlin-backed sanctions deal into the White House on a day he was meeting with the president himself and never raised the matter of the document in his possession with Trump directly strains credulity. That he would later claim to have left the White House without giving the documents to Flynn is also hard to believe. Cohen's narrative is especially improbable given that, as the nation was learning that very month, Flynn had been the presidential transition's covert point man on sanctions negotiations with Russia. Artemenko's proposal would therefore have been of enormous interest to the Trump administration generally and to Trump and his national security adviser specifically. Speaking to the Huffington Post 6 months later, Cohen changed his story once again. He now suggested that his friend Sater hadn't told him in advance whom he would be meeting with, and that at the meeting, Artemenko handed him a long brown envelope which he both never opened and yet could reliably report contained one or two pages. He went so far as to confirm his knowledge of the length of the document by saying, "When was the last time you saw a peace proposal on one piece of paper? SAT computations for algebraic equations take at least two pages or more." He added that he rejected Artemenko's request to pass along the proposal because, for reasons he did not clarify, he had no interest in what he was selling. This explanation might be difficult for investigators to accept, given that Artemenko had represented to Cohen that the proposal came with the Kremlin's imprimatur, and that Artemenko had gone to the 2016 Republican National Convention, attended Trump's inauguration, and visited Congress as part of his lobbying efforts in Washington. All of these actions beg the question of what it was in the Steele dossier Comey shared with Trump on January 6th that initiated Trump's intense concern about federal law enforcement's ongoing consideration of Russia's ties to his presidential campaign. Following the Steele dossier's January 10, 2016 publication by BuzzFeed, conversation about its veracity began. Andrei Soldatov, writing for The Guardian, argued that, based on his experience covering the Russian secret services since 1999 and having spent the last 5 years researching Russian cyber activities, Steele's dossier rings frighteningly true. Overall, it reflects accurately the way decision-making in the Kremlin looks to close observers, wrote Soldatov, adding, "The Trump dossier is a good reflection of how things are run in the Kremlin, the mess at the level of decision-making and increasingly the outsourcing of operations, combined with methods borrowed from the KGB and the secret services of the lawless 1990s in Russia." A review of the dossier's key claims suggests that a great many of them have been confirmed. CBS News wrote that investigations and criminal cases are revealing some truth in the dossier and have begun to resolve at least some of the questions surrounding the memos. Newsweek reported that former Director of National Intelligence James Clapper had concluded that more and more of the infamous Steele dossier is turning out to be true. CNN wrote in early February 2017 that U.S. investigators have corroborated some aspects of the Russia dossier, and in the United Kingdom, The Independent observed that Trump denounced the document as fake, but much of the dossier's contents have turned out to be true. As individual claims in the dossier have been confirmed, the media has taken note, such as when the pension scheme described in the dossier by which the Kremlin made clandestine payments to its agents was confirmed as still in existence. At the time, the BBC wrote that a key claim in the dossier had just been verified. After Carter Page's congressional testimony, Business Insider wrote that the former Trump National Security Advisor's testimony was filled with bombshells and supports key portions of the Steele dossier, particularly with respect to whom Page met with in Moscow in July 2016 and the fact that he did indeed discuss the privatization of Rosneft with at least one executive from the company, Andrei Baranov. Former FBI Director James Comey concluded in 2018 that the dossier came from a credible source, someone with a track record, someone who was a credible and respected member of an allied intelligence service during his career. Moreover, the dossier gained credibility with both American and foreign journalists when one of its suspected sources, Oleg Erovinkin, a former KGB chief turned top aide to Rosneft CEO Igor Sechin, was found dead in Moscow in the backseat of a car on December 26, 2016, not long after the FBI took possession of a copy of the dossier. According to Christo Grozev, an expert on Russian security threats interviewed by The Telegraph, Erovinkin was likely the source Steele mentioned in his dossier as being a close associate of Sechin. According to Grozev, insiders have described Erovinkin to me alternately as Sechin's treasurer and the go-between between Putin and Sechin. One thing that everyone seems to agree on, both in public and private, is that Erovinkin was Sechin's closest associate. I have no doubt that at the time Erovinkin died, Mr. Putin had Mr. Steele's Trump dossier on his desk. He would, arguably, have known whether the alleged story is based on fact or fiction. Whichever is true, he would have had a motive to seek and find the mole. He would have had to conclude that Erovinkin was at least a person of interest. The Daily Beast concurred with Grozev's judgment that Erovinkin's death might have been dossier-related. The notorious dossier on Trump that Republicans want to discredit may well have been credible enough in Russian President Vladimir Putin's eyes to get at least one person, Erovinkin, killed, wrote the digital news outlet in January 2018. It noted, too, that initial reports on Erovinkin's death announced that he had been killed, but the reports were subsequently altered without explanation to read that Erovinkin had simply died. The possibility that Erovinkin was a steel source was aired officially when Glenn Simpson, the head of the firm that hired Steele, was asked a question about the dossier during a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing, and his attorney, Joshua Levy, suddenly interjected, "Somebody's already been killed as a result of the publication of this dossier." Erovinkin's death was one in a string of suspicious deaths of influential Russian figures, CNN noted in March 2017. Andrei Melanyan, a senior diplomat at the Russian embassy in Athens, Greece, the city where Papadopoulos sought to make clandestine contacts with Russians or Russian allies in 2016, died suddenly of natural causes less than 2 weeks after Erovinkin. On election day in November 2016, Sergei Krivov, the Russian consulate's duty commander for security affairs in New York City, was found dead. Russian officials first told investigators that Krivov fell from a roof, and then that he died of a heart attack. But the police report ultimately filed that day identifies the apparent cause of death as an unknown trauma to the head. In March 2017, Nikolai Gorokov, the former lawyer for Sergei Magnitsky, after whom the sanctions Putin wanted so urgently for Trump to drop were named, fell from the fourth floor of his Moscow apartment and nearly died. He had been continuing his old client's fight against corruption in the Kremlin. In all, 9 prominent Russian officials died under suspicious circumstances, often a heart attack, in the 9 months after Trump's election victory. Broadly, the Steele dossier alleges that the Russian regime had been cultivating, supporting, and assisting Trump for at least 5 years, from 2011 to 2016, a claim supported by Kremlin-connected Russian nationals' repeated outreach to Trump for business deals, including overpayment for his properties in the United States. This outreach began at least 5 years before the 2016 presidential election, and possibly even 15 years before Trump's November 2016 victory. See Chapter 1. The dossier says Putin's aim between 2011 and 2016 was to encourage splits and divisions in the Western alliance, an ambition that has been confirmed many times over by Putin's attacks on NATO and the European Union, his government's meddling in the Brexit vote, and his attempts to sow discord within America via social media in the run-up to the 2016 election. Of still graver concern, however, is that Trump, perhaps because of cultivation, support, and assistance from Russia, has put forward since 2011 a foreign and domestic policy that dovetails with Putin's designs on Western democracy, particularly with respect to the NATO alliance. Trump has declined to affirm NATO's Article 5, its mutual defense clause, and more recently scrapped the trilateral NAFTA agreement between the United States, Canada, and Mexico. The dossier correctly notes that Trump has not followed through on any proffered deals from Russia this decade. It would have been more salacious for the dossier's sources to claim otherwise, but the dossier is sober on this point. The dossier does indicate that Trump has received a regular flow of intelligence from the Kremlin, a claim that now seems prescient as it was recorded by Steele 6 months before the FBI interviewed Papadopoulos about his back channel to the Kremlin. This was a back channel that in April 2016 led to his discovery that the Russians were stealing emails from Americans, or at least claiming to have done so. The dossier points to Manafort as a key manager of Trump-Russia coordination, which tracks with both Manafort's past work on behalf of Russian interests and the discovery in September 2017 that Manafort had offered a close associate of Putin, Russian oligarch Oleg Deripaska, private briefings on the internal machinations of the Trump campaign. There is substantial support for the dossier's claims about Russian compromat collected in November 2013. See Chapter 3. CIA officers who spoke to the BBC on this issue through an intermediary confirmed the dossier's core contention, that there are compromising videos of Trump. The dossier also makes the explosive allegation that Putin personally oversaw the recent Kremlin operations interfering with America's political process. In January 2017, a consensus report from the nation's three foremost intelligence agencies confirmed that Putin directly ordered the 2016 influence campaign that helped Trump secure victory at the polls. Part of Putin's plan, says the dossier, was to sow discord and disunity within the United States itself through an extensive program of state-sponsored offensive cyber operations. Certainly, Special Counsel Mueller's 2018 indictments of Russian nationals connected to Russia's GRU, military intelligence, and its so-called Internet Research Agency confirm that segment of the Steele dossier. The dossier's depiction of the Kremlin's power structure tracks with what is presently known of it, from the centrality of Dmitry Peskov and Sergei Lavrov to the Kremlin's use of people who have family and ethnic ties to Russia and/or have been incentivized financially to cooperate. The description of recruiting such people by incentivizing them financially to cooperate seems to explain the actions of Felix Sater, Michael Cohen, Trump's two Trump Soho partners, and many other Americans in Trump's orbit from the mid-2000s onward. The dossier's reference to Putin's reliance on Jewish Americans with a Russian ethnic background matches the unusual number of Israeli persons and organizations, like Joel Zammel and his firm Wikistrat, Black Cube, and the mysterious Israeli who met George Papadopoulos in Tel Aviv, who connected with Trump's aides and advisors in the United States and abroad. Indeed, Israeli newspaper Haaretz observed that of 10 billionaires with Kremlin ties who funneled political contributions to Donald Trump and a number of top Republican leaders, at least 5 are Jewish. The dossier contends that Michael Cohen traveled to Prague in late August or early September 2016 to assist Trump in coordinating with the Russian government. In April 2018, McClatchy reported that Special Counsel Mueller indeed has evidence that the trip occurred. While some of the allegations in the dossier are unverifiable, and so may, due to their nature, remain unverified, as former Director of National Intelligence James Clapper said in May 2018, none of the dossier has been disproven. Chapter 13. Testimony and Plea. June to December 2017. Summary. Once FBI Director James Comey is fired and Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein appoints Robert Mueller special counsel, the investigation into Trump-Russia collusion continues with even greater vigor than before. As Mueller and his team, which includes 40 of the top attorneys and investigators in the country, request or subpoena large numbers of potentially inculpatory documents, including Trump's personal banking records and all Russia-related documents in the possession of the Trump Organization, there are major developments on the testimonial side of the Trump-Russia case as well. Key witnesses in the investigation either disappear, become unavailable, get arrested, or are successfully corralled into hours of testimony before Congress that reveals in many instances that they have not been telling the truth. In Europe, George Papadopoulos's primary conduit to the Kremlin, Joseph Mifsud, suddenly disappears without even telling his fiancée where he's gone. In the United States, Papadopoulos himself is arrested. Mueller's team meets with Christopher Steele to debrief him on his dossier, and even as Steele continues to refuse to testify before Congress, Trump advisors Eric Prince and Donald Trump Jr. do so. But when both men testify extensively before Congress, their interrogations reveal substantial holes in their accounts of what they did during the presidential campaign. In October 2017, Trump's campaign manager Paul Manafort and his deputy campaign manager Rick Gates are indicted on 12 federal charges, including conspiracy against the United States. Later in the month, Papadopoulos pleads guilty to lying to the FBI, an event that seems to presage Trump's former national security adviser Michael Flynn being charged with the same offense, cutting a cooperation deal with special counsel Mueller and pleading guilty to one count of making false statements in December 2017. Meanwhile, the congressional investigation of Trump-Russia collusion moves ahead, even if progress is slow and the results unclear. Sessions and Comey testify again before Congress in June 2017. In July, Jared Kushner meets with Senate investigators and Paul Manafort with the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. In August, Mueller's grand jury interviews June 2016 Trump Tower meeting participant and former Soviet intelligence officer Rinat Akhmetshin, and the Senate Judiciary Committee interviews Fusion GPS founder Glenn Simpson, the man who hired Christopher Steele to compile raw intelligence about Trump's business dealings abroad. Donald Trump Jr. testifies before the Senate Judiciary Committee in September and the House and Senate Intelligence Committees in December. Mueller's team interviews former White House Chief of Staff Reince Priebus, former Trump campaign national co-chair Sam Clovis, and former White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer in October 2017, as well as current Trump domestic policy adviser Stephen Miller in November. The Senate Select Committee on Intelligence interviews Corey Lewandowski in October, and the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence questions both Carter Page and Eric Prince in November. With each new indictment, plea, and transcript of testimony, as well as new reports on Russia's social media meddling from Facebook and Twitter, and on Russia's electoral infrastructure hacking campaign from the Department of Homeland Security, the breadth and depth of Russia's attack on the United States in the run-up to the 2016 presidential election becomes clearer. This clarity stands in stark contrast to two puzzling events that cast a long shadow over the second half of 2017. Trump's insistence in July on meeting Putin face-to-face and multiple times under highly unusual circumstances during the G20 summit, and his inexplicable delay in carrying out new sanctions against Putin and his oligarchs that are overwhelmingly passed by Congress the same month. The facts. As the first year of Trump's presidency wears on, the beleaguered president becomes more and more erratic. He floats the possibility that he has secretly recorded James Comey before retracting that claim. He brags about his ability to pardon whomever he wants, including himself. He attacks his own attorney general in the media, suggesting that he wouldn't have nominated him had he known Sessions wouldn't protect him against investigations of his conduct. He signs into law new Russian sanctions passed by a stunning 517-5 vote in Congress, but fails to carry out the sanctions by the deadline required by the legislation. Throughout 2017 and beyond, he pays more than $200,000 in legal fees to his personal attorney Michael Cohen out of his campaign coffers, despite Cohen being a witness in a federal criminal investigation Trump has reason to believe is looking into his own actions. And after Putin cuts U.S. diplomatic staff in Moscow in retaliation for President Obama's December 2016 cuts to Russian diplomatic staff in the United States, Trump thanks Putin for saving the United States money, telling Americans in August 2017 that he is very thankful for Putin's decision. Throughout the latter half of the year, the scope of Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election becomes clear. In September, Facebook admits that Russian troll farms purchased thousands of ads on the popular social media platform, turning over more than 3,000 of them to Congress. Later that month, the Department of Homeland Security informs 21 U.S. states that they were hacked by the Russians prior to the election. In subsequent months, DHS will amend the number of states hacked to 39 and admit that 7 states' election systems were, in fact, compromised by Russian hacking. September also sees Twitter joining Facebook in acknowledging the role social media played in Russia's election year operations, with the companies confessing that just that month, it shut down hundreds of accounts run by Russian operatives, accounts that spent in total hundreds of thousands of dollars to spread Kremlin propaganda in the United States. Having declared on June 9, 2017, from the Rose Garden at the White House that he is 100% willing to be interviewed by Mueller and would be glad to do so, Trump has nevertheless taken no steps to do so by December 2017. And by the end of the year, he will have called Mueller's investigation a witch hunt 14 times on Twitter. Behind the scenes, Trump is raging, threatening to fire Jeff Sessions, Rod Rosenstein, and/or Robert Mueller should the Trump-Russia investigation continue. Indeed, in the very month he says he'd be happy to be interviewed by the special counsel, he orders his White House counsel Don McGahn to fire Mueller, backing off only when McGahn threatens to quit his job. Having failed to rid himself of Mueller, less than a week after stating his willingness to cooperate with the former FBI director, he will imply on Twitter that Mueller and the other attorneys leading the Trump-Russia investigation are very bad people whose conflicts of interest, he alleges, disqualify them from working on the case. On October 30th, 2018, Trump will say, "I'll see what happens," when asked by the media whether he will even honor a judge-issued subpoena from the special counsel, adding that the special counsel's investigation is illegal. Meanwhile, the several ongoing congressional investigations marked by fierce partisan infighting continue. From Emin Agalarov's publicist Rob Goldstone, Senate judiciary investigators learn a great deal about how the participants of the June 2016 Trump Tower meeting scrambled to square their stories in July 2017 after public scrutiny began of the Trump Tower meeting, with Goldstone messaging both Emin Agalarov and Ike Kavaladze, a vice president at the Agalarov's Crocus Group, after news of the meeting broke to ask how to respond. One result of these contacts appears to be Goldstone changing his story as to who he believed was at the meeting he attended. Whereas in June 2016, he had told Trump Jr. he was bringing a Russian government attorney to Trump Tower as part of Russia and its government's support for Trump, after he corresponds with the Russians, he will say the meeting was in no way connected with the Russian government or any of its officials. The Senate Judiciary Committee discovers, too, that Donald Trump Jr.'s lawyer sent Goldstone a statement for him to issue after the meeting was made public, which Goldstone then forwarded to Kavaladze. Bloomberg calls this an apparent effort to keep their stories consistent. Trump Jr.'s attorney asks Goldstone to begin his statement with the claim that "The statements I have read by Donald Trump Jr. are 100% accurate." Investigators also learned that when Goldstone emailed Trump Jr. and Trump himself via Rona Graff in January 2016 to offer massive exposure for Mr. Trump on the Russian equivalent of Facebook site, and it will be covered in Russian media also, where your campaign is covered positively almost daily with extremely gracious comments from President Putin, Graf did in fact respond to this offer of foreign assistance to Trump's presidential campaign. Though the proffered massive exposure on a Russian social media site called VK had high in-kind value and might therefore be construed as an illegal campaign contribution, Graf wrote Goldstone in response to the offer, whether on her own initiative or on Trump's behalf is unclear, that it was a terrific opportunity, and that Goldstone should follow up with Dan Scavino, the Trump campaign's social media director. By the time Goldstone wrote Scavino about receiving this assistance from the Agalarovs and VK, he was able to represent that Don Jr. and Paul Manafort had told him they were, in CNN's description of the email, on board with the idea. While a source will tell CNN that Goldstone brought up the idea for a Trump page on VK to Trump Jr. and Manafort at the end of the Trump Tower meeting in June 2016, Trump Jr. will insist that he has no recollection of it when he testifies before Congress. Investigators also learned that just 5 days after the June 2016 Trump Tower meeting, when news dropped that Russian hackers had accessed Democratic National Committee emails, Goldstone emailed Emin Agalarov that the news was eerily weird in light of the meeting Goldstone had just attended at Trump Tower. In the same tranche of emails, congressional investigators also find an email to Ike Cavalaja from his son George, in which George asks his father of Donald Trump Jr.'s decision to release his emails to and from Emin Agalarov, why did he release this email admitting to collusion? The email's subject line is DT Jr. From Corey Lewandowski, the Senate Intelligence Committee learns that Donald Trump Sr. does indeed use a blocked number, suggesting that Trump's son may have called him when, after discussing a prospective June 2016 Trump Tower meeting with Emin Agalarov for the first time, he called a blocked number whose owner he insists to Congress he cannot recall. Lewandowski does not answer all the questions asked of him, however, and by January 2018, he is refusing to answer any questions about events that took place during the campaign and his conversations with President Donald Trump since then, though his legal rationale for either refusal is unclear. Steve Bannon will later attempt to do the same. As it turns out, however, campaign conversations are not privileged, and former campaign advisors who do not work in the White House as presidential advisors cannot assert executive privilege or adopt a president's assertion of executive privilege. Bannon will later say that the White House told him to invoke executive privilege. The result of his stonewalling is a subpoena from both the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence and Special Counsel Mueller. After a brief negotiation, Mueller allows Bannon to interview voluntarily with his office instead. Another witness who cooperates with Mueller but not Congress, albeit for very different reasons, is former MI6 agent and dossier author Christopher Steele, who speaks with Mueller's team in the summer of 2017. Shortly thereafter, in August 2017, Fusion GPS founder Glenn Simpson's testimony to the Senate Judiciary Committee includes some startling new revelations about Steele. Simpson recounts how Steele withdrew his cooperation with the FBI 1 week before the 2016 election because he believed the FBI was being manipulated by Trump insiders. The timing of Steele's withdrawal from his partnership with the FBI is noteworthy as it coincides with Trump advisors and allies Rudy Giuliani, Eric Prince, Donald Trump Jr., Michael Flynn, Joe DiGenova, and Steve Bannon working, see Chapter 10, to get leaks from active FBI agents into the media, with the apparent aim of getting FBI Director James Comey to focus on the closed Clinton email investigation rather than the still-pending Trump-Russia investigation. Steele's suspicions about pro-Trump factions within the FBI were heightened when, on October 31, 2016, the New York Times cited FBI officials for the proposition that no conclusive or direct link between Mr. Trump and the Russian government had been found. Steele considered the FBI's representation false and withdrew from cooperation with the Bureau on that basis, Simpson testifies. Before their partnership ended, however, Steele got into with the FBI who his sources were, how he knew certain things, according to Simpson. Even more startling, Simpson testifies that the FBI told Steele it had a source inside the Trump campaign, an internal Trump campaign source whose intelligence indicated the same thing as the dossier, and one of those pieces of intelligence was a human source from inside the Trump organization. Simpson declines to say who the source is, citing security reasons. Whether those security concerns involve him or someone else is unclear. Months later, in a January 2018 op-ed in the New York Times, Simpson will publicly stand by his 2017 testimony, underscoring that Fusion GPS never told Steele whom he was working for, that Fusion was not the entity that leaked Steele's dossier to BuzzFeed in January 2017, and that the commercial research firm never spoke to the FBI about Steele's work at any time. Simpson will add that our sources said the dossier was taken so seriously by the FBI because it corroborated reports the Bureau had received from other sources, including one inside the Trump camp. The intelligence committees have known for months that credible allegations of collusion between the Trump camp and Russia were pouring in from independent sources during the campaign. Simpson's op-ed appears to reject a popular Republican conspiracy theory, which supposes that the FBI used a mole, someone not native or ever adopted into the Trump campaign, to report on the campaign's activities through sporadic engagement with it in 2016. The Guardian will quote a person close to the matter as saying that Simpson was referring to George Papadopoulos as the source inside the Trump camp, but this will remain unclear even after Simpson's New York Times op-ed. The ongoing mystery of the Simpson-cited human source is fueled by a letter from Senate Judiciary Committee Republicans to Simpson in which they highlight a phrase from Simpson's testimony that seems to describe neither George Papadopoulos nor University of Cambridge fellow Stefan Halper, the subject of the right-wing conspiracy theory about an FBI mole. Halper had only intermittent contact with three Trump advisors as an outside observer of the Trump campaign. Simpson's testimony clearly refers to a human source from inside the Trump organization who decided to pick up a phone and report something. In August 2018, the New York Times will reveal that U.S. law enforcement and the U.S. intelligence community have lost nearly all their human sources of information in Russia, in part because Trump and his congressional allies insisted on burning Stefan Halper as a confidential informant on Russia by naming him publicly. According to the Times, among other potential factors, officials also raise the possibility that the outing of an FBI informant under scrutiny by the House Intelligence Committee, an examination encouraged by President Trump, has had a chilling effect on intelligence collection in Russia. Investigators also make some unexpected discoveries involving Michael Cohen. From January through August 2017, an American company controlled by Russian oligarch Viktor Vekselberg paid Michael Cohen $500,000, depositing the money, the purpose of which remains unknown, into the same shell corporation, Essential Consultants LLC, that Cohen had set up for the exclusive purpose of paying off Trump's ex-mistresses. The news raises the possibility of Trump receiving illegal campaign contributions or other illicit payments from a foreign national through Cohen. Slate, noting that Essential Consultants is a single-member LLC that was created just a month before the 2016 presidential election and that Vekselberg's company indeed stood to be affected by Trump administration decisions, will call explanations for the payments given by Vekselberg's company and others ridiculous and speculate that a more likely explanation is either bribery or a cash-for-access contribution to a sleazy hush-money slush fund. That Cohen also receives payments from other companies into the same account and that the services he is ostensibly being paid for do not match up with his areas of expertise further suggests, Slate will argue, that these payments are not on the level. The New York Times will note that Cohen also used the company, Essential Consultants LLC, to collect $250,000 after arranging payments in 2017 and 2018 by a major Republican donor, Elliot Broidy, to a former Playboy model he allegedly impregnated. Notably, Trump named Cohen and Broidy co-deputy finance chairs of the Republican National Committee in April 2017, as Cohen was still collecting money from Broidy to cover up his alleged affair. That during this period, Broidy, alongside Mueller cooperating witness George Nader, was selling access to Trump for $1 billion to the governments of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, makes Broidy's payments into Trump's ex-mistress slush fund even more problematic. New York Magazine will write that Broidy was likely giving Trump more than money for his lobbying access. Basing its conjecture on knowledge of the backgrounds and known behaviors of Broidy, who has been accused of paying off the girlfriend of a friend before, and Trump, who has a well-documented history of having unprotected sex with women in the adult entertainment industry, the magazine contends that Playboy playmate Shara Bashard became pregnant not by Broidy, but by Trump. The magazine cites as part of its evidence the fact that Bashard was paid off through a contract that used Trump's longtime alias for such hush money payments, David Dennison. Among the persons and entities contributing to the $4.4 million Cohen received through Essential Consultants in 2017, Victor Vexelberg is a particularly troubling example. Vexelberg attended Trump's inauguration, as did Kremlin agent Natalia Veselnitskaya, former Soviet intelligence officer Rinat Akhmetshin, and accused Russian spy Maria Butina, and is subject to U.S. sanctions on Russian persons and entities. These are the sanctions that Putin was pushing in 2017 and, even now, to have repealed. Even more strikingly, Vexelberg sat next to Putin at the same 2015 RT gala that Michael Flynn attended while he was advising then-candidate Trump on national security issues. According to Business Insider, Vexelberg is closely aligned with Putin, with whom he frequently meets to discuss business. Moreover, two of Vexelberg's American associates donated a combined $1.25 million to Trump's inaugural committee. These donations, coming as they did from Russia-connected Americans rather than Russian nationals, might have gone unnoticed, but for the fact that, as of January 2018, tens of millions of dollars are missing from the inaugural fund Vexelberg's associates donated to, raising the possibility they were steered to private individuals. Trump's inaugural committee collected approximately twice the amount, and for a relatively modest inaugural celebration, that President Obama did for the more expensive of his two inaugurations. The man in charge of Trump's inaugural organizing committee was his good friend Thomas Barrack, who at the time was lobbying him on nuclear reactor sales to Saudi Arabia alongside Michael Flynn, Rick Gates, and Bud McFarlane. This confluence of facts will lead Mueller's team to, in March 2018, stop Mr. Vexelberg at a New York area airport, search his electronic devices, and question him. All told, in the first year of Trump's presidency, the total payments to Cohen's shell corporation, $4.4 million, will dwarf the payout to Trump's mistress Stormy Daniels, $130,000, for which the corporation was ostensibly originally created. When Senate investigators interviewed Jared Kushner in July 2017, they discover that his defense to accusations of untoward conduct is his own inexperience. Kushner tells investigators that the reason he had to update his federal security clearance forms so many times, with officials discovering more than 100 errors or omissions, a record of non-disclosure Charles Phelan, director of the National Background Investigations Bureau, will call the worst he's ever seen, was that he had thousands of meetings and exchanges during the campaign, and that some, including the many Russian contacts he left off his SF-86 form, were not impactful or memorable. In saying, "I have never seen that level of mistakes on an SF-86 form," Phelan will note that Kushner's initial SF-86 form did not mention any foreign contacts, and that his subsequent update of the form added 100 contacts, but still did not mention the June 2016 Trump Tower meeting. In his July 2017 statement to congressional investigators, Kushner will claim to have never initiated contact with any foreign officials, though he will concede that he set up Trump's April 2016 Mayflower Hotel speech and that at the VIP event beforehand, he did communicate separately with each ambassador, including Sergei Kislyak. Kushner will further say that he did tell Kislyak, as he told the other three ambassadors when he met with them, according to his statement, that he hoped they would be interested in Trump's fresh approach to foreign policy. Oddly, Kushner tells investigators that he doesn't remember speaking on the phone to Kislyak even once, though Reuters reports he has done so at least twice. Despite Reuters having six sources who are U.S. officials saying that Kushner had multiple contacts with Kislyak by telephone, Kushner will tell investigators he is highly skeptical any such calls occurred. And although sanction relief for Russia is critical to the good deal Trump spoke of during his speech at the Mayflower Hotel, Kushner tells investigators that when Natalia Veselnitskaya brought up the Magnitsky Act sanctions in Trump Tower, I had no idea why that topic was being raised. He will add that he thought nothing more of the meeting after he left it and believes no part of the meeting I attended included anything about the campaign. As for his meetings with Kislyak and VEB Chairman Sergei Gorkov during the transition, Kushner says he solicited neither meeting. Furthermore, Kushner asserts that it was Kislyak who wanted to discuss Syria with him and Flynn rather than the reverse. He makes this assertion even though he was the architect of Flynn being brought aboard the transition team. Flynn had been in contact with Kislyak prior to the election, and after the election, Flynn immediately moved to get involved in Syria policy, possibly as part of a grand bargain to simultaneously end U.S. sanctions on Russia and Russian support for the Iranian militants aiding Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. As for his meeting with Gorkov, Kushner will denounce Gorkov's description of the event, just as he had in the same statement denounced the intelligence community's description of his contacts with Kislyak, and insists that at no time was there any discussion with Gorkov about my companies, business transactions, real estate projects, loans, banking arrangements, or any private business of any kind. Just 2 months after Kushner says, following his two-hour interview with Senate investigators, hopefully this interview put these matters to rest, the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence will discover, not from Kushner, but from TV, that Kushner has a secret private email server he never disclosed to the committee. Moreover, the only reason Kushner's private server makes the news is that his attorney, Abby Lowell, accidentally sent an email to a prankster who was pretending to be Kushner. Lowell thereby revealed the existence of an email server his client had not disclosed to investigators. In November 2017, a bipartisan letter from the Senate Judiciary Committee to Kushner will accuse Trump's son-in-law of providing, even after the revelation of his private email server, incomplete information to Congress. The letter will accuse Kushner of not disclosing emails related to WikiLeaks and Kushner's security clearance form that originally omitted certain contacts with Russian officials. While Kushner, in the statement he issues after his congressional interview, will present himself, as summarized by Rolling Stone, as having been out of place, confused, and polite during the June 2016 Trump Tower meeting, as well as arriving late and leaving early, Goldstone's testimony to Congress will paint an entirely different picture. According to the British publicist, Kushner became agitated and infuriated when the Russians didn't provide the dirt on Clinton that Kushner had apparently anticipated, suggesting also that, contrary to Trump Jr.'s testimony to Congress, Kushner had foreknowledge of what the meeting was about. Little is known about Rinat Akhmetshin's August 2017 appearance before the grand jury convened by Mueller, as grand jury proceedings are secret. In an interview not long after his testimony, however, Akhmetshin will tell the Financial Times that Veselnitskaya told Trump Jr., Manafort, and Kushner about bad money ending up in Manhattan and being put into supporting political campaigns. Akhmetshin's implication is that the campaign in question was Hillary Clinton's. It is unclear what legally obtained official documents and information, to use Goldstone's characterization of Veselnitskaya's evidence, the Russians intended to provide or did provide the Trump campaign to establish that allegation as true. However, Akhmetshin will be clear on one point over the course of his media interviews. Veselnitskaya did indeed give documents to the Trump campaign during the June 2016 meeting. One additional note about Akhmetshin's conduct in Trump Tower will come not from Akhmetshin, but from Agalarov employee Ike Kavaladze, who testifies to the Senate Judiciary Committee about the former Soviet intelligence officer's highly inappropriate pink attire at the meeting. A significant observation given that Trump Jr. will cite Akhmetshin as the one Russian in the room whose presence he couldn't thereafter remember at all. While little is known of Priebus's mid-October interview with Mueller's team, the Washington Examiner reports in March 2018 that Trump attempted to get Priebus to tell him what Mueller's agents had asked him. One likely topic of discussion was the contemporaneous memos Comey wrote in early 2017 about his interactions with President Trump and his staff. According to an April 2018 report in the Washington Post, Comey wrote, shortly after a February 8, 2017 meeting with Priebus, that Priebus had asked to have a private conversation with the FBI director and then requested a key piece of information from him. Whether there was a FISA order on then National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, who had attended Trump's August 17, 2016 classified security briefing with the candidate and then New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. Comey answered at the time that the question was inappropriate. It needed to be asked and answered through established channels, but gave Priebus the information he was looking for anyway, though his answer is redacted from his memo before it is made public. Priebus's question is curious, because any FISA order on Flynn might have picked up conversations Flynn had in December 2016 with other Trump officials about his conversations with Sergei Kislyak. And Priebus was one of the officials K.T. McFarland kept in the loop about Flynn's ongoing sanctions negotiations with the Russians. In fact, Priebus was scheduled to be on a call with the president-elect and his whole national security team on the day Flynn conducted his negotiations with Kislyak. If Flynn were to have been on that call while under a FISA warrant, both Priebus and the president-elect might well have had their statements about negotiating with the Russians captured. As the Washington Post notes, the fact that Priebus asked Comey on February 8th about whether Flynn was under surveillance suggests Priebus may have had reason to believe that Flynn's transgressions were more serious than just lying to Pence. If that's true, the chances that Trump didn't know that Flynn had done something extremely serious are shrinking. In October 2017, Sam Clovis, the man who hired both George Papadopoulos and Carter Page, one of whom has already pleaded guilty to a federal felony and the other of whom invoked his Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination before the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, is interviewed by Mueller's investigators. He then testifies before Mueller's grand jury in October 2017. Within 72 hours of his cooperation with Mueller being revealed to the public, Clovis withdraws from Trump's nomination of him to be the chief scientist at the Department of Agriculture. One of the senior members of the Senate Agriculture Committee, Senator Patrick Leahy, Democrat Vermont, says at the time that at Clovis's confirmation hearings, he would have asked the former Air Force colonel about his knowledge of Papadopoulos's back-channel communications with the Russians. After Clovis's withdrawal, Leahy will call Clovis almost a comically bad nominee, even for this administration. According to Reuters, one of the key topics Mueller's team had asked Clovis about under oath was whether Trump knew of Papadopoulos's back-channel communications with the Russians. Papadopoulos, one of Mueller's cooperating witnesses, has said that Trump did indeed know about his communications with the Russians, with Newsweek noting that, according to Papadopoulos, Trump met with him one-on-one. And he told Trump about his ongoing efforts to set up a meeting between Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin. Papadopoulos will later change his story and say that the first time he ever met Trump was at the Trump International Hotel in D.C. on March 31, 2016, 10 days after Trump singled him out as an excellent guy in an interview with the Washington Post. that Flynn's December 2017 plea deal requires him to plead guilty to only a single count of making false statements to the FBI confuses many who have followed the Flynn headlines. As Lawfare writes, Flynn's behaviors raised a raft of substantial criminal law questions. His problems include, among other things, an alleged kidnapping plot to capture and extradite a dissident Turkish cleric to Turkey, a plan to build nuclear power plants all over the Middle East, alleged violations of the Foreign Agents Registration Act involving at least two different countries, Turkey and Russia, and apparent false statements to the FBI. Flynn's deal is based on stipulated facts that add little to the public's understanding.